afternoon, everyone. This is Dolores Beasley at NASA Headquarters in Public Affairs, and I want to once welcome you to today's telecon, Hubble Weighs In on the Heaviest Stars in the Galaxy. We'll start with remarks from our panelists, and then after that, we'll go to the media for questions. And we ask that you keep your phone on mute and also turn off cell phones, pagers, and anything else that makes noise electronically. Before we begin, I want to make sure that everyone has found a link to the website. Okay. At this point, what I'd like to do is introduce today's moderator, Dr. Jennifer Wiseman, who is the Hubble Space Telescope Program Scientist here at NASA Headquarters, and she will introduce the rest of the panel. Jennifer?
Thank you, Dolores. Good afternoon again. We have some very exciting news from the Hubble to report. Some of the most important questions in astrophysics today concern star formation. We want to know how stars form in interstellar clouds and how the environment around them affects their development and what kinds of stars can form, and also how star formation has changed throughout the history of the universe. And one thing we've never really known is just exactly how massive a star can be. There are different theories that predict mass limits and just how massive a star can be before it becomes unstable or cannot hold itself together. And today we actually have some observational results from the Hubble that can tell us, perhaps help us set what that mass limit can be on stars. So we're very excited to have Dr. Don Figer, who's an associate astronomer at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, to announce his results from the NICMOS camera of HST. And then we have two experts joining us to comment on how this discovery fits in with the rest of what we're learning about the universe. One is Dr. Sally Uy, who's an assistant professor of astronomy at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Dr. Uy is an expert in studying the most massive stars, and how they affect the evolution of galaxies. And she and her colleague, Dr. Kathy Clark, have done a similar or a related study on looking for mass limits in star clusters, mass limits of stars. And then we're also pleased to have Dr. Stan Woosley joining us. Dr. Woosley is a professor of astronomy and astrophysics at the University of California in Santa Cruz. And Dr. Woosley is an expert in theoretical astrophysics, including all kinds of stellar evolution. And he likes to say that he's also interested in things that explode, stars that explode, supernova, gamma ray bursts, and so forth. We hope his interests are confined to stellar things that explode. So, therefore, we welcome the panel, and I would like now to ask Dr. Don Figer to tell us about his results and maybe walk us through the graphics that we can see on the Internet as well. Don?
Sure. Thanks, Jennifer. For the past 100 years or so, astronomers have tried to calculate the maximum birth weight for a star, and the estimates span a very large range from as low as about 10 times the mass of our sun to thousands of solar masses. Today we present the most stringent upper limit to the masses of stars using Hubble observations of the densest young cluster in the galaxy. We conclude that stars do not exceed 150 solar masses at birth. I'd like to go to the first graphic on the website, graphic number one. This illustration shows the spectacular compact and massive star cluster in the center called the Arches Cluster, as seen from a vantage point in the galactic center looking back on the Earth. The brightest dozen or so of the stars have inferred initial masses much greater than 100 solar masses. The galactic center, which is home to the supermassive black hole, can be seen in the upper right surrounded by a spiral of ionized gas that's falling in the black hole. If we could now go to graphic number two. Hubble provided the real breakthrough that led to this result, as you can see from this panel. Here's a progression of images, the first two obtained on ground-based telescopes in the 90s, and then the third one from Hubble using the near-infrared camera on multi-object spectrograph. So the initial images clearly show that there's something interesting going on, and it's obvious that it's a cluster. But the image on the right is clear enough that we can actually count the individual massive stars. And it's this type of accounting that directly leads to the result. And finally, if we can go to the third graphic. Okay, so this plot tells the whole story. In fact, this is all we need to understand the result as it came from the data. Here we see that the Arches cluster contains many more lower mass stars than higher mass stars. And that's typical of clusters seen everywhere in the universe. But unlike any other cluster in the galaxy, we can see that there is a sudden drop in the number of stars around 150 solar masses. This is the upper mass cutoff, and this figure provides the strongest evidence for its existence to date. Jennifer?
Thank you very much, Okay. Thank you very much, Donna. This is very interesting indeed. And so now I would like to know how, Dr. Uy, how do you feel that this discovery is important in looking at stellar populations?
Well, you can see from this third graphic here that there are always many more small stars than big stars. So the richer the cluster, the better your chances of finding the biggest stars. But the importance of this result stems from the fact that this is the richest cluster in our galaxy, and it most clearly shows that there is a lack of these extremely large stars. However, this is only a single cluster, which could be a unique object. It turns out that our statistical analysis of 9 other clusters in the Milky Way and the neighboring Large Magellanic Cloud also demonstrates a lack of extremely large stars. So the Arches cluster is a 10th cluster that agrees with this result, and it's also the one where the statistical confidence is the highest.
Thanks very much. And that's because there are many more stars in the Arches cluster, is that correct?
Exactly.
Very good. Thank you very much. And Dr. Woosley, can you tell us a little bit about how you see this fits in the big picture of our understanding of stars and stellar evolution?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Jennifer. These are fascinating results, especially for someone who's always been attracted by every bright blinking light he happens to see. Don has studied the heaviest and brightest stars that exist in the present universe. Each of the stars in those upper mass bands is over 100 times the mass of the Sun, and each of them has a brightness over 1 million times that of the Sun. Stars like that appeal to me because they live short, extravagant lives and go out with a big bang. No star over 100 solar masses lives longer than 3 million years compared to our Sun's 10 billion years. And they all die a supernovae, too. So the number of such stars is interesting for a variety of reasons, and I'll try to give just a few. Maybe some more will come up in the discussion. But first, it's interesting simply to know what the biggest, brightest star is that can exist nowadays. We know the lightest, about 8% the mass of the Sun, but what's the heaviest? Apparently it's around 150 times the mass of the Sun, but why? Is it that such stars simply never form, that you can't get that much mass together and make it burn? Or do they form, but they just live very short lives and pulse apart and lose mass until they reach some stable lower weight around 150 times the mass of the Sun? The distinction's important when we talk about the early universe, and I'll come back to that a little later. Second reason we're interested in these big stars is they're the big element makers. All of the elements in the universe except hydrogen and helium have been made in stars over 10 times the mass of the Sun. And different masses of stars make different elements. For example, a 100 solar mass star makes a lot of carbon, oxygen, neon, and sodium. So in order to understand the cosmic inventory of all the heavy elements, we need to know just how far up in mass the stellar scale exists and how many 100 solar mass stars there might be for each 10 solar mass star. What's the proportionate weighting of these big things? And the present study suggests, by the way, that there seem to be a lot more 100 solar mass stars for every 10 solar mass star than we used to think. And that's going to affect our views of galactic composition evolution. The third reason these stars might be interesting is because they're so big that they're hard to explode. In the end, their cores are going to collapse either to neutron stars or black holes. And probably these stars will end up making black holes. They have such large gravitational binding, they're hard to blow up. And if the stars rotate even makes a black hole in its middle, it might make a gamma ray burst, and that's certainly one of the brighter lights around. Finally, and it might be a little technical, but right around 150 solar masses, a new kind of supernova mechanism comes into play. If the star hasn't lost most of its mass to winds before it dies, such a huge star encounters a nuclear instability right after it finishes burning helium in its middle and explodes as a giant thermonuclear bomb, hypernovae, some people call them, some of the most brilliant explosions in the universe. So what the present study conclusively shows is that for the Arches cluster and probably for other regions with similar composition, there's a sharp cutoff at some maximum mass. And using a combination of observation and theory, Don estimates that a mass corresponding to 150 solar masses when the cluster was born about 2 million years ago is the cutoff. But again, whether this means more massive stars never formed or are unstable and pulse and quickly come apart is not known. And the reason this distinction is important is because stars with no heavy elements in them might have very different stability properties. It's still quite possible that when the universe was young and made out of just hydrogen and helium, that stars of several hundred solar masses existed and did a very different sort of evolution than the 150 solar mass stars. So I think we're perhaps ready for questions, Jennifer.
Thank you very much. I appreciate everyone's comments, and we'll now be going to our reporters for their questions, but I want to start with the first one, if I may. I'll take the prerogative, being the program scientist here. Having such massive stars in the cluster, does that affect whether or not new stars, does that disrupt the environment so much that new stars would have trouble forming in that cluster? Don, do you have any response to that, or maybe Stan?
Well, I can give you the observational perspective.
Okay.
In the Arches cluster, in fact, we have an accurate count of all the stars down to two solar masses, which really isn't shown in this figure because it's not that important from the point of view of the upper mass cutoff. But we have a full accounting down to two solar masses, and those stars are there. Oddly enough, there's a sharp rollover just below 10 solar masses. So just below the left side of that plot, the counts go flat. They don't increase anymore. And there are two arguments for why this might happen. One is that the low-mass stars get ejected through interactions with high-mass stars, or that they didn't form in the first place. And if they didn't form in the first place, one of the arguments is it's because of disruption from the massive stars.
I'll try to answer as well. I mean, clearly we see a cluster of stars now and not a cloud of gas, so star formation has stopped. But usually it's the big stars that form the quickest and the lower mass stars that form the slowest. So the fact that we see all these low mass stars, as Don said, suggested that the formation of the big ones at least wasn't truncated by their own light.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm going to now turn this over so that our reporters can ask questions. Ray Villard from the... Dolores.
Before we get started, before we turn it over to Ray Villard at the Space Telescope Institute, who will facilitate questions, I just want to set a couple of ground rules. We'll take one question and one follow-up from each member of the media, and then if who would like to ask questions, and if there's time, then we'll go back. Again, please mute your... phone when you're not on. So thank you. Ray?
Okay, thank you, Dolores, and I'd like to extend a warm welcome from everybody here at Space Telescope Institute to our reporters. I've got a list of everybody attending here. Let me go through that list for Dolores' ground rules, and let's start with Mark Caro from the Houston Chronicle. Mark?
Could you discuss again how rare these large stars are? I wasn't quite sure whether they're very, very rare or just rare. And do you have a mass for the sun? Is there some way to quantify that in pounds or tons?
Okay, I'll take that question. There are probably demonstrably a few dozen of these stars above 100 solar masses in the galaxy. But that word demonstrably is important because there likely are many more, but they're hidden. Massive stars form in the disk of the galaxy, and the disk is full of dust. And so only recently have we been able to look along the disk, and we're far from surveying it completely. The mass of the sun is 1 on this plot. I know that doesn't help.
It's about 300,000 Earth masses.
There you go. Thank you.
Okay.
Just a second. This is Dolores Beasley. Quick program note. Before you answer a question for our panelists, please, since the people can't see you, identify yourself. Thank you very much.
Oh. Okay. Guy Gugliotta from the Washington Post.
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay, I thought we were on listen only. When you look at these, and could you describe a little more as to how you identify them as very large? How do you make the measurement?
Okay, yeah, this is Don Figer. I'll take that question. There's a series, short series of steps that we go through in order to convert the Hubble image into the plot in graphic 3. So from the image, we can measure the amount of light coming from each of the stars. And that's a fairly straightforward process. In fact, you could even look at the image and probably guess which stars give off more light than others. But in addition to that, we need to know how far away the cluster is, because if it's closer, then the star doesn't have to emit as much energy for it to appear to be bright. It would just be bright because it's closer. So we need the distance. We get that from the fact that the cluster is in the galactic center. We also need to correct for the absorbing effects of dust, and that's a simple matter of measuring color. That's a straightforward step in the process. We also need to know the age in order to relate the amount of light emitted to a mass. And for the age, we use spectroscopic data to precisely measure the helium and nitrogen content in the stars. Finally, from the age and the amount of light, we get the mass by using a stellar evolution model. We used a variety of different models. In fact, I even added I did some simulations assuming errors in the age. I purposely chose the wrong age compared to the observation. And I found over and over and over again there's a limit no matter what you do.
Just as a follow-up, I think you said, and if I got it wrong, could you repeat it, that large stars only last I think you said up to 3 million years
right
before they explode. Why is that?
They run out of their fuel, so they live fast and die young, so to speak.
They're shining at a million times the rate of the sun, but they only have 100 times the mass, so they can't live very long.
That's good.
Again, a reminder, I believe that was Stan Woosley who just finished.
Yeah, Stan Woosley.
Okay, we're going to go on to try looking forward to today.
Hear me? Excuse me, Ms. Chris Kreiler, you may speak now. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, you can hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry, it's low-tech here. This might not actually be relevant to the study, I'm not sure, but is there a sense of, say, like in the early universe, there were more big stars versus small stars, or the other way around, or because the big stars are short-lived, there were actually fewer of them, or can you talk about that at all?
Yeah, this is Stan Woosley. I think I'd try to take that. There is a belief that in the early universe, the typical masses of stars was larger, and it has to do with the theory of star formation and how it depends on the composition of the star. In order to make a small star, you need to have a lot of cooling, and it's hard to cool if there's no elements present except hydrogen and helium. And so some of the simulations that have been done have found that the typical masses might have been around 300 solar masses. And so that was one reason I mentioned in my discussion that the stability of those stars and whether they pulse and come apart quite early in their evolution might be quite different. In fact, there have been analyses done that suggest they're much more stable than stars that have heavy elements in them.
Okay, we're going to go on to Robert Burnham from Astronomy Magazine.
Okay, I hope you can hear me. My question, I guess, is a Actually, I have two questions, but one of them is, what shuts off the growth, or conversely, another way to put it is that why 150 solar masses? Why not 175 or 100? That's the question.
Thanks, Justin. This is Don Feiger. From the observations alone, we find that 150 is the most likely cutoff, and the probability that it's 175 is a whole lot less. Now, why this should be, we don't know for sure. There have been all sorts of theories for why the mass might be limited, but no one really was able to produce a reliable number, and so we really need to use observations to try to constrain the theory.
Okay.
This is Stan Woosley. I'll take a stab at trying to explain it qualitatively, but no precise number comes out. There's two ways the upper mass could be set, either by growth from below or shrinkage from above. If you form a star, the theory is that you first form a lower mass protostar that accretes a lot of its mass from matter around it, but as it is growing in mass, it's also growing in brightness, and eventually its own brightness truncates its growth, and you stop at some upper mass. The other idea, though, which I rather favor, is that as you go to bigger and bigger stars, the source of the pressure that's holding them up is different. The sun is held up by ordinary gas pressure. The nuclei and electrons in there are banging into one another and making pressure. But in stars over 100 solar masses, a large fraction, the bulk of the pressure, comes from light itself. And it's been known for many decades that if you try to create a star made entirely of light with just a little matter to hold the light in, that it's unstable, that it will come apart. And so 150 solar masses might be the point at which the star has lost enough mass that it's not being overwhelmed by its own radiation pressure and making itself unstable.
Okay, if I could follow up with a question. This is a cluster. It's reasonably crowded. What would happen if you ended up with two of these 150 plus or thereabouts mass solar stars colliding or combining into a single body?
Don might want to take that.
Sure. Well, it's actually quite a theoretical question because that's never been seen before. But I will say that there are very massive stars that are in binary systems. As much as 80 plus 80 solar mass stars, components in a binary system. There are arguments that the two stars would combine and form a single star with the combined mass of the masses of both of the components. There are also arguments saying that there's no way that would happen and that the radiation pressure would blow away any newly added material. So we're in theory land on this one.
Thank you.
Hey, we're going to move on to Steve Craney from Capital News Service.
Go ahead, Mr. Crane, your line's open.
I'm sorry, there's no question.
Okay, Dennis O'Brien from Baltimore Sun.
If there's an upper limit of 150, what about this the discovery of this pistol star that's 200? Is that the exception to the rule?
I think I'll take this one. This is Don Feiger again. The original estimate for the pistol star, which I made along with my team, was 150 to 250 solar masses. Unfortunately, that's a big error bar, but that's part of the business of trying to model a star that's on the brink of destruction like the pistol star. So the lower limit is consistent with this upper mass cutoff. I can also add that we are revisiting the mass of the pistol star in an upcoming paper that we're just finishing now with my collaborator, Paco Najaro, in Madrid.
If I could add something to that, this is Sally Uy. One of the things that we clearly don't know very well either is how absolute the upper mass limit is. Is it squishy? Is there actually a range of masses at the top there that are allowed, or is it really just absolutely going to be at 150 and you can't find another star at 151 times the mass of the sun? I think this cluster clearly demonstrates that there is a truncation in this particular cluster, but before we look at more objects,
we won't really, more clusters, I mean to say, it will be hard to tell exactly what the absolute limit is. And it may turn out that the pistol is more massive than 130 times the mass of the sun, and that would just be another data point we would have to look at.
Dr. Uy, can I just, this is Jennifer Wiseman, just wanted to ask you if that 150 solar mass limit, does that fit in with your results from looking at the statistical information from several other clusters that you looked at?
Yes, it definitely does fit right in with that.
Terrific, thank you.
This is Stan Luth. I'd comment as well. I think we seem to be discussing the error bar on the upper limit, and it could be significant, I think, but what's quite important here is that an upper limit has been demonstrated, that there is a very sharp cutoff, and whether it's exactly 150 or 130 or 170 may vary from place to place, but this number, you have to realize, also involves some theory, because stars may start off with 150 solar masses, but by the time they're just 2 million years old, they've already boiled matter off their surface and are down around 60 to 80 solar masses. So there's some extrapolation back in the model that Don uses to trying to predict what the mass was when it was born, because we don't observe it when it's born. We observe it 2 million years later. And in that theory, there's certainly some room for error, and I think there's easily 20 solar masses of possible error there.
Okay, moving on to Jessica Berman from Voice of America.
Berman, your line is open.
Mike Scribner from space.com.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yes. I guess this question would be to Dr. Woosley. You mentioned something about the elements that come from the different distribution of masses. I just wonder if you could elaborate a little bit more on, you know, what elements are coming from 100 solar mass stars versus 10 solar mass or smaller.
Yeah, this is something we're in the process of studying right now, and it's certainly true that in order to understand all of the elements that we see in the sun and in the cosmos, that you have to include all the different masses that contribute. You can't just take a 15 or a 25 or a 40 solar mass star, evolve that, and get the answer. You have to combine everything. Just what 100 or 120 solar mass star would give has a lot to do with this mass-losing history that I was alluding to earlier. It may be, and in fact, in current theory, a 100 solar mass star ends up as only 6 solar masses when it dies. All the rest has been boiled off in a stellar wind. And so it's the composition of that wind which is very crucial to determine its contribution to nucleosynthesis. And such things as, I mentioned, carbon, oxygen, neon, and sodium are quite copious in the winds of massive stars like that. And so it may be that they've contributed disproportionately to those elements.
Okay, Richard Harris from National Public Radio. Okay, moving on to Robert Noya from Sky and Telescope.
Okay, hey, one moment. Okay, Mr. Nyer, your line's open.
Okay. Yes, I wanted to ask, since the upper mass limit of a star in a given cluster will depend on the metallicity of the cluster, what is the metallicity of the Arches cluster relative to the sun?
This is Don Figer. I'll take that. You made an assumption in your question that the upper mass cutoff is a function of metallicity. That's not known. That's one theory, and in fact, that's part of what we're trying to address here. The Arches has a metallicity that's roughly solar. Now, in the nearby Large Magellanic Cloud, Sally and others have observed another cluster called R136 that has a cutoff, that appears to have a cutoff that's similar to the value we get. And in that case, that cluster has one-third the solar metallicity. So apparently, with two data points, and I don't know if we can extrapolate too much from this, but from those two data points, the upper mass cutoff does not vary over a factor of 3 in metallicity.
Bob, this is Stan. I'd comment on that as well. The metallicity can have two very important effects. One is, starting with a given mass, it affects what mass you end up with when you die. I mentioned 6 solar masses as maybe the final resting consider the universe, as you know, we're talking about metallicities less than 10,000 that of the sun, and there things may be qualitatively different.
Okay, let's see, moving on to David Melody from Associated Press.
Sir, your line is open. Mr. Melody?
Okay, let's move on to Warren Leary from New York Times.
Sure.
Yes, a couple of questions. I guess the first one's to Dr. Woosley. You mentioned that perhaps in the early universe there were much bigger stars form, and it was just mostly hydrogen and helium out there.
Yes.
Aren't there in some parts of the universe now those similar kind of conditions where we might see bigger stars, much bigger than this, being still being formed?
It's hard to the clusters that can be observed the way Don has observed with so many stars in them and with such precision are pretty much limited to our galaxy, and there isn't anything that we could look at that would have very low metallicity that close up. The real difference, as I was mentioning to Bob, sets in when you've got about 10,000 times less heavy elements than the sun. And those regions were such, long ago and far away that I don't think we can make measurements there.
The second question, I guess, to Dr. Figer, as Jess was mentioned, mostly looking at our galaxy and by neighborhood. How typical is that, a large assumption, as in the stars? How typical is the Milky Way, and how assured are we that this process we're seeing is a universal process?
I'm sorry, but you dropped out a little bit there, so let me just try to reiterate. This is Don Figer, by the way. I think you're asking if the process that would provide an upper mass cutoff would be universal throughout the galaxy. Is that correct?
Yes, and essentially, how typical is the area we're viewing here in the Milky Way and in terms of galaxies, and could there be completely different type of processes in other galaxies?
Yeah, okay, fine. So I think we can talk about theories that might suggest things should be different in the center of the galaxy versus elsewhere in the galactic disk, or why things might be different in our galaxy versus, say, the Large Magellanic Cloud. That might be so, but the approach that I'm taking is to make observations, and we started at the galactic center because that's where we found the only object in the galaxy that could show a firm upper mass cutoff. So we'd like to observe in other regions, but you need to search where there's actually an object that could provide a result.
Said that the LMC gave you a very similar result, so that's a different galaxy giving a very similar result.
Yes, and furthermore, this is Sally Uwe. We also did a study where we looked at 9 clusters. One of them was the one alluded to in the Large Magellanic Cloud, but we also looked at 8 other clusters, which were much more typical of the large clusters that you'd find in the local universe. These are all clusters in the galaxy and the Large Magellanic Cloud, but I say typical because they're smaller, and you obviously find a lot more small clusters than enormously rich things like the Arches, which is in a very unique position in the center of our galaxy. So it is very interesting that, in fact, the result that Don is finding in this very unique cluster in the center of our galaxy in what one might consider to be an extreme environment is actually producing a result that is very, very similar, pretty much exactly the same as what we see for the mass limit in smaller clusters elsewhere.
Okay, moving on to Akemi Yoshimoto from Kaito News Service.
Okay, your line is open.
Okay, Christopher Glenn, and if you can state your affiliation.
One moment. Go ahead, Christopher Glenn.
I have no questions.
Okay, Kevin Robertson, and if you can state your affiliation, please.
One moment.
Yes, just a private citizen, very interested in the Hubble. I have no questions.
Okay, and then Peter Tamblyn.
I have no questions at this time, thank you.
Through our list of reporters, let me make one more loop to see if there's any follow-up questions. I'll start with Mark Carroll.
Yes, I do have a follow-up. In an imaginary solar system like ours, what would a sun at the upper limit look like from the Earth? Would it over overwhelm the, you know, I don't know, what would it look like?
I'll give one short answer. It would be really, really bright. It would be really big. It'd be about 25 times the size of the sun and a million times brighter, and of course the Earth would boil and be vaporized, and most of that light would be coming out in the ultraviolet, by the way.
To help you out, Mark, we did a quick calculation. It would be a little bigger than the size of your fist held at arm's length. The sun is half the size of your forefinger held at arm's length. This would be a honking star.
And who spoke each time, please?
Lisa? Who spoke? Oh, this is Ray Villard.
And Stan Woosley spoke first.
Yeah. Okay, Guy Gugliotta?
Could I just interject one comment here? This is Jennifer Wiseman from NASA headquarters. We also have to remember that what we're looking here is at mass limits, not necessarily size limits, right? So you can have larger, unusual large stars, red giants and so forth, that might be, you know, larger in diameter for various reasons, but not as massive as some of these massive stars. I think that's correct. Is that correct, Don?
Yeah, in fact, there's a graphic that supports that description. The red giants are huge, and the sun's going to be a red giant, and it'll envelop the Earth. But its outer layers are so tenuous, you wouldn't even know that you're inside of it. Of course, if you were looking towards the center, it would be really bright, but otherwise, it would just be a very tenuous gas.
That's right. So we want to make sure we understand we're talking about mass today and not necessarily physical size and diameter. Thank you.
Okay, let's see. Guy Gugliotta?
I'm good, thanks.
Okay. Let's see. Chris Cridler?
Cridler,
I'm sorry.
Nothing, thank you.
Robert Burnham?
One moment. Mr. Burnham?
Yes. Yes, okay. I don't know if you can hear me. A bit of crosstalk here. Anyway, what I wanted to do is just follow up. Quick question. I heard two figures given for the lifetime of stars greater than 100 solar masses. It was 300 million years or 3 million years. Could somebody clarify that? I think it was Stan Woosley who gave...
3 million. If I said 300, I misstated.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks. Nothing for Steve Craney?
No, nothing.
Thank you.
Brian?
Dennis O'Brien, your line is open.
No questions.
Jessica Berman?
Ms. Berman, your line is open.
Okay, let's go to Mike Scribner.
Hello, Michael Scherber. I was wondering, there's how many stars are in the Archer's cluster? Is that different than the mass? I mean, is there dark matter there? And how many have you measured? What percentage?
Right, this is Don Figer. There are a few thousand stars in the cluster, and collectively they have 10 to 12,000 solar masses. That ratio is a little bit odd compared to what we see in other clusters, because it tells you that the average mass of a star is at least a few solar masses. Usually it's about one, and that's just telling us that the mass function on the low end is very odd. It's very flat, and I would estimate that we're about 90% complete in counting all the stars in the cluster.
Okay, let's go back to Robert Noya.
Mr. Noya, your line's open.
Okay, yes, I wanted to ask a follow-up question, and that is, how well constrained are these mass estimates, given how little we know about extremely high-mass stars? I mean, are there any stars, you know, of over 100 solar masses in binary systems where we can directly measure the masses, or is this just really very extremely model-dependent?
Yeah, this is Don Figer. There's an 80 plus 80, which matches the model pretty well and was discovered last summer. I want to say something that Stan actually said before, and that is the result here is that there's a cutoff. That's the primary result. The secondary result that it's about 150 solar masses. There's no way to get rid of the cutoff by having the uncertainty in the models unless you start injecting differential uncertainties, pretending that one star obeys the laws that you think you know and other stars don't obey the laws.
Okay, moving ahead, Dave Melendy.
Mr. Melendy, your line's open.
I'll pass for now.
Okay, we'll move on to Warren Leary.
A couple of very basic quality questions. One, would someone verify the age of our current sun and how much longer it's expected to last? Secondly, there was a mention made earlier of a large star, I think you said Fistful star. What is that? When was it discovered, and how do you spell it?
Stan Woos, the age of our sun is 4.55 billion years, and it's expected to live in its present form about a total of 10.4 billion years. So it's got on the order of 5 to 6 billion years to go.
Okay, this is Don Figer, and I barely heard the question, but let me try to give an answer. The Pistol Star is in a very rare stage of evolution. There are only a half dozen or so stars in the galaxy that are in the same stage. In this rare stage, it's barely able to hold itself together, and so it spews out material into space. And in fact, if you look at the Pistol Star image from Hubble that was released in 1997, you can see about 10 solar masses of material that came from the star itself and that it spewed out. So in that case, it's very difficult to make a mass estimate. It's one of the most difficult stars to model properly. Our original estimate is 150 to 250, and right now we're taking a look at a revision based on new updates to the metallicity tables in our models.
And again, the spelling of that, please.
Well, Pistol Star is P-I-S-T-O-L.
Thank you.
Don, this is Jennifer Wiseman. Could you also comment on whether or not it's possible the Pistol Star could have formed in an unusual fashion for it to maybe be more massive than what would form, you know, naturally in the Arches cluster?
Sure. So I didn't even comment on that, but let's talk about that a little bit. Since the original announcement, I've realized that the cluster in which the Pistol resides contains stars that are about 4 million years old. But that should be a problem, given what we've heard today on this press conference. Such massive stars only live 3 million years, so why would the Pistol Star be 4 million years old and still have enough mass that it should have already exploded? So the implication is perhaps that it's a binary composed of two stars that have less mass, or that it was a binary and recently merged. So the Pistol Star is really an open puzzle. So just to make a more general statement, there is no star in the galaxy that credibly violates this upper limit. And when I use the word credibly, I mean in any case where there's a suggestion that the star exceeds the limit, there's something funny going on. And one of those is the Pistol Star.
So what you're looking at in the Arches cluster as a whole, and what Dr. Uy has looked at, is sort of what you see in regular, in clusters of stars, as sort of a natural limit to the masses when stars are forming normally, and then you might find a few unusual outlying cases, such as the Pistol Star, that may have formed in an unusual way. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to move on to Akemi Yoshimoto from Kaito News Service. Okay, we have gone through our list of media folks, but before I hand it back to headquarters, Don, can you give your office number and email address to the reporters?
Sure. You can feel free to contact me at 410-338-4377, and my email is my last name, Figer, F-I-G-E-R, at stsci.edu.
Okay, Dolores?
Okay, thank you very much, panelists, and I have a couple of program, very important program notes I'll need to make, but before I do that, I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Wiseman to see if she has any final comments.
Thank you. I just wanted to say I think that Dr. Figer's results are quite interesting. He's taken advantage of the fact that we have this very massive cluster of stars so that we can do proper statistical analysis of these numbers of stars at the highest mass in, and has found a cutoff. And yet this cluster is within our own galaxy, so we can do the proper statistics, and there aren't very many of these around. So I think this is a quite interesting result and will result in more theory to try to understand why there might be such a cutoff. I appreciate all our panelists today. Thank you, Dr. Uy, and thank you, Dr. Woosley, for joining us as well. And so, Dolores, back to you.
Okay, thank you. First of all, for reporters who may have missed the beginning or some of this media telecon, this conference will be replayed until 5 p.m. this Friday by calling the following number, 866-427-6407. Again, that number is 866-427-6407, and the passcode is 2468. That's one announcement. The other is I want to inform you all that our next Science Mission Directorate media event will be a Spitzer NASA Science Update, which will be March 23rd at 1 p.m. Eastern. Now, that will not be a call-in. That will be live on NASA television from NASA headquarters. And that concludes my program notes. That also concludes today's telecon. Thank you all for listening in, and stand by for more information from NASA. Thank you very much. Goodbye.